Osiris. Folks, I'm David Goldstein.
I am Brian Brinkman.
You are tuned in to episode 77 of the Beyond the Pond podcast. This is the podcast which, generally speaking, Brian and myself utilize the music of Phish as a means of introducing the listener to other bands. These are usually not jam bands. Because we love Phish, we are Phish fans. But the problem with Phish fans is sometimes they get a bit myopic, able to recall dates, set list, times, exactly what they ingested at a certain show and how it affected them looking at the lights at that show. But when it comes to other bands, they just stare at you blankly. And that's problematic.
It's very problematic. And there's got to be someone who can do something about this, right, Dave?
Yeah, us.
I think that we're going to do the best we can to be those people that can do something about it. And we are here in episode 77 to do something about it. We are revisiting the mother of all Phish festivals.
What, Curveball?
One of the best.
No.
No. And perhaps one of the 10 best music festivals that has ever happened. In its 20th anniversary here, we are talking about Big Cypress once again. If you listen to our episode in early June on the Split Open and Melt from Big Cypress, this is our second of third of three episodes that are coming out in 2019 covering the festival. We are going to talk tonight about the Cross-Eyed and Painless from deep into the all-night set at Big Cypress Seminole Indian Reservation on December 31st, 1999.
Some of the themes we're going to discuss in this episode include late-night intensity and speed. You could say that the band was living after midnight. Tonight we're going to party like it's 1999. Still waiting. And on that note, let's get to some Phish. Folks, so the question is, why this jam? Why are we devoting an evening to talking about the Cross-Eyed and Painless from Big Cypress? Well, this jam was incredibly fast. It's locked in and it's driving. Like, this is like being really, really focused on the Autobahn at 2 o'clock in the morning. You're being chased, and all of this really kind of kicks in around the 14-minute mark of the jam. This is the kind of jam that, due to the ravages of age, certainly through no fault of their own, Phish isn't really capable of playing anymore. And that's fine. I mean, I'm turning 40 in a week, and I can barely bend my lower back without moaning about it. And what's kind of a little crazy is knowing that, I mean, at this point, there's another, you know, what, like 6 hours of music after this jam? Like, they cool themselves off by playing the in-law Josie Wales right afterwards, but I just can't even begin to imagine where the endurance came from. It almost makes you wonder how they were ever to do a normal, quote, tour ever again, but they did.
Yeah, and then you follow this up after in-law Josie Wales with 40 mind-bending minutes of sand in a quadraphonic toppling. Still the only quadraphonic toppling that has ever been played. It's just blows me away that they were ever able to not only tour, but play like just a simple standard show ever again after Big Cypress. Because the jamming.
Yeah, it's like once you reach the apex of the mountain, where do you go?
Right, right. I mean, it's you listen to a jam like this, knowing that this came in a set after the Down with Disease, after the Bathtub Gin, after the Twist. And now you get this 20-minute raging cross-eyed and painless. And following this, there's going to be sand, quadraphonic toppling. There's an amazing Reba. There's the 35-minute Roses Are Free, a Piper that's insane. Like, it's just incredible the quality of music that was being thrown out over a seven-hour all-night session that will probably never be topped in Fish's history. And that's okay.
That's fine. Like I said, I was not at Cypress. I was at a party in New Brunswick, New Jersey that wasn't terribly exciting, but I think I had a good time. There's probably some kind of keg of Yingling. That's what we like to drink in New Brunswick in 1999. So we're just going to go through quickly some very noteworthy versions of Cross-Eyed and Painless. To kick us off, Brian, what do we got?
So you got to start with the second version ever played by Fish, November 2nd, 1996, Coral Sky Amphitheater. This was the first show following Halloween 96. It's mind-altering and expansive in the way that November 96 could, in ways that almost no other tour could. It's just fantastic, 27-minute wild jam. Fast forward. July 29th, 2003 from Burgettstown. I would argue personally that this is the best ever version of Cross-Eyed and Painless. It is so 2.0 in the best week of 2.0. And then jumping into 3.0, where there's quite a few great versions, because this was a very rare song in late 1.0 and all of 2.0, you have July 31st, 2009 from Red Rocks, which is a really unique version. And if you haven't heard this, I would encourage you to seek it out. And the segue into Joy is really, really beautiful.
Going forward, we have October 16th, 2010. Charleston, South Carolina, some quality ambient jamming in fall 2010. June 12, 2011 from Meriwether Post Pavilion. Stays type 1, but it's fire. Quite insane peak. And then what may be easily one of my personal favorite shows of all time. August 19, 2012 from Bill Graham. It has some outstanding ambient jamming, almost kind of sounds like a riff on the Grateful Dead classic, The Wheel. And this is the beginning of what I would like to think is the best third quarter of all of 3.0. I never think of Cross-Eyed. I just think of Cross-Eyed, Light, Sally, and few things in this world make me as happy as that Cross-Eyed, Light, Sally.
Jumping into 2013, we've got July 10th, 2013 from Homedale. Really unique jamming, rhythmic perfection from Trey, kind of similar to the February 16th, 2003 Piper from Las Vegas. October 17th, 2014 from Eugene. I would argue this is one of, if not the most underrated jam of 3.0. It kills me every single time when they change keys and they come into the Still Waiting. It's so haunting. It sounds like Fish Fall Tour in the Northwest in such a unique way. I love, love, love that jam. And then January 17th, 2016 from Mexico, which is a really unique version with some shipwreck quotes.
Yeah, Brian's not kidding about his love for 10-17-24 from Eugene. One of these days, we're going to release a lot of stuff that ends up on the cutting room floor from Beyond the Pond. And it's like 6 hours of it is just Brian telling me how much he loves 10-17-24 from Eugene.
And then it's just us bitching about baseball. So it's those three topics that we talk about behind the scenes.
Yeah, the Eugene Show and baseball, basically. Anyway, we have two more on this list. Of course, July 25th, 2017, from the Garden, jam-filled night. I was there, 33 minutes, two massive peaks separated by an extended ambient jam. And then July 22nd of 2018 from the Gorge, excellent ambient jamming, one of the best sets of 2018 by far.
Absolutely. And so transitioning here, if you listen to our Cyprus Split Open and Melt episode, episode 67, we talked about December 1999, the tour leading up, as well as the first set of December 31st, 1999. So we wanted to cover here in this episode December 30th, the night before the night. Really, really fantastic show. Definitely gets overlooked because of what happened the following evening. But I love this show. I think it's really good to throw on. It's kind of a mix between a really solid Fish Festival set and a really, really good barbecue set, in the sense that there's some odd song selections, there's some standard moments, and I don't think they really lock in for a complete set, but I love it all as a complete package, if that makes any sense.
Absolutely. No, for that set one, I would agree. Also, the stuff where the Seminole Chief Jim Billy comes out, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, there's just, you can tell they're kind of realizing, you know, there's a moment in It where I think it's right around the Reba in set one of 8203, where Trey, there's like a pause after the song and Trey steps to the mic and goes, we're just trying to figure out what to play here, and we're realizing like we don't have any place to go for 2 days, and the whole audience goes crazy. And you kind of hear that on like a larger scale in set one of December 30th. You've got a really appropriate and fitting Water in the Sky, and every time they sing Filter Out the Everglades, and wherever you are seeing Fish, the entire place goes crazy. And then you get the first light up or Leave Me Alone since March 1st, 1989, which at the time was 1,092 shows, as well as the first Karina since February 18th, 1989, which at the time was 1,096 shows. So they're having a ton of fun up on stage, which is really cool to hear.
The second set of that show has a very gorgeous tweezer, very, very yeah. pretty, into taste. Epic, epic Harry Hood. But I mean, the one thing I keep coming back to on 1230 is absolutely earth-shattering version of Mike's song.
Yes.
Where if you watch this, there's a lot of footage of this show on like YouTube, right?
There is, yeah, especially of the Mike song. That's really, really high quality.
Yeah, red lights, evil intensity. It's just, you're crushed under a wall of sound. Like we talked recently on this podcast about the Tool song Parabola. There's a bit in that where it gets like the notes are so thick you can't breathe. Mm-hmm. That's like as close as Fish came to helping you not breathe in this like Mike song.
Yeah, it. I feel like the only comparable jam that at least that's coming to my mind is the MoMA Dance from Brooklyn 2004, where they just get into this, and the Ghost from Dix this year was slightly there, in the sense that it's just very tribal, it's haunting jamming, it's very drum based, and Trey's just like kind of strumming a chord over and over again with more right. intensity. The Ghost from go ahead.
No, yeah, strumming intensity and stepping on pedals like a shoegaze jam.
Yes, yeah, exactly. It's just like they're building like a wall of noise. The Ghost from Northerly Island in 2014, you know, you can kind of compare it to that in that sense. But, you know, this is taking the peak of, you know, Fish's playing in terms of late 90s connectivity, applying it to a festival and a show where they know the next night they're going to play all night long. And they're here playing like a full three-set show in front of all their fans. Like, I honestly wouldn't have been surprised if they would have played a two-setter that just didn't deliver in any way. But the fact that they went for a true festival show is something that just should be applauded completely for this.
Absolutely. So on that note, let's get back to what we're originally focusing on, and we're going to play a segment of the Cross Eyed and Painless from December 31st, 1999, from Big Cypress. Thank you.
that you guys enjoyed that raging version of Cross-Eyed and Painless. One of my favorite versions of the song that's ever been played. So as we were planning this episode, we were thinking about the fact that this Cross-Eyed and Painless, not only is it perhaps probably the fastest version of the song that's ever been played, but it also happened at like 2 o'clock in the morning. It's crazy. Mm. Like this wasn't, you know, when Phish comes out for their second sets at 10 o'clock at night and everyone's already kind of settled into the show following first set and set break, it's always wild to me when they play with a ton of intensity, you know, and how they muster that energy. To think that they did it at 2 a.m. knowing that they had 5 more hours of music is just mind blowing to me. So we were thinking about late night intensity, late night speed, kind of raucous energy. And it had us come back to two very familiar men that we absolutely love. We adore them as songwriters, as musicians. We are both constantly listening to these guys, no matter what our listening projects are, no matter what we're preparing for. And we were like, you know what? Fuck it. There's no reason why we shouldn't honor Big Cypress with Neil Young and Bob Dylan. You know, we talk about them a lot, but there's a reason for that. So we're going to feature songs from Neil Young and Bob Dylan in their most raucous, intense way possible. And up first, we're going to talk here really quickly about Neil Young and the album in particular, Time Fades Away, his live record from 1973. Like I said, we've covered Mr. Young on this podcast many times, and rightly so. We even covered Time Fades Away in episode 28, which was Wingsuit with RJB, the Podfather. And in that context, we were discussing live albums that were somewhat controversial in the way Wingsuit was. Here, we're discussing it because of the raucous energy of the show and how that compares to the Cypress Cross-Eyed. Now, I'm guessing most of our core listeners know this record front to back. But for those who don't, either like this podcast, like Neil Young, like sloppy guitar solos, if you like tours filled with controversy and angry, aggressive young crowds, this album is for you. This was recorded on the tour that supported Harvest in 1973. And it was here that Neil began his dive into, or his drive, if you will, into the ditch. And you can kind of imagine this tour was similar to Dylan's 1966 tour, which featured an acoustic set followed by an electric set that the latter of which enraged many fans. Dave, I know you are a huge fan of this album as well. What are your thoughts?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is the tour when he debuted a whole bunch of new songs with his band at the time, which was the Stray Gators. And really, not many fans wanted to hear them because the album that came out before this, Harvest, that was a huge smash. I mean, you figure if you see Neil Young after Harvest, you want to hear, you know, like Heart of Gold, right? And, you know, Heart of Gold, maybe Alabama, Man Needs a Maid, or just whatever. Maybe not A Man Needs a Maid necessarily, but like whatever.
Out on the Weekend.
Yeah, exactly. Out on the Weekend. Right. That's what they're looking for. But this was a bunch of unreleased songs at the time. So there was a little animosity and angst. And I think he did 62 dates in 3 months.
Yeah.
I mean, at this point, I'm just going to recommend, if you want to more interested about this tour and Neil Young in general, his the Neil Young biography, Shaky, by the author Dream McDonald, which came out in the early 2000s, is definitely one of the more thorough, one of the more interesting takes on the the Time Fades Away tour. I mean, this was the tour Neil developed a serious taste for tequila. There was some alcohol abuse, which amounted to a throat infection. Graham Nash and David Crosby were recruited for backup vocals, but they don't come off as angelic. They come off as these like ghosts on the side of the stage. It's really quite creepy. And really, I mean, this album, it wasn't this record, it came out in 1973, but until 2017, I think it wasn't like available on vinyl. It wasn't available on CD.
Available on CD. Yeah. 2017, okay. He finally released it. And
Of course, it was on vinyl. It was reissued, but it wasn't available on CD.
I was recently home and I was looking through my dad's record collection, and he has this on vinyl from the early 70s. And I remember asking, and it's like all worn up, and I was blown away by it. And I don't know why it wasn't a record we listened to that much as a kid. I think it's because Neil hated this record for years. In 1987, he told an interviewer that Time Fades Away was, quote, the worst record I ever made. But as a documentary of what was happening to me, it was a great record. I was on stage. I was playing all these songs that nobody had heard before, recording them, and I didn't have the right band. It was just an uncomfortable tour. I felt like a product, and I had this band of all-star musicians that couldn't even look at each other, which sounds pretty miserable, but also makes for some really great rock and roll, especially in hindsight.
And what's incredibly funny is that that interview was done in 1987. So he says Time Fades Away was the worst record he ever made, when in fact Landing on Water, which came out in 1986, could very well be the worst record he's ever made.
The 80s were a strange time for him.
The 80s were a very strange time.
I mean, this record, it's just fascinating. It sounds almost like a grunge record 20 years earlier. And I remember the first time I heard it, this really like reopened a huge interest for me in the work of Neil Young, especially this kind of approach from him. It took me away from the more acoustic side of Neil, more into this kind of thrashy, late night raucous party of Time Fades Away, On the Beach, Tonight's the Night, Even Zuma, and then fast forward into records like Year of the Horse, Psychedelic Pill. I mean, I feel like there's two sides to Neil in so many ways, in terms of this soft-spoken singer-songwriter with an acoustic guitar and this very loud psychedelic, very, very classic rock artist that is expanded using the guitar in so many different ways for the entirety of his career. And this really kind of sparked that interest for me in a lot of cases.
It also has one of the best album covers of all time.
Yes.
Just depicting this like insane, smoky 1970s era, like arena. When you think of like 70s arena rock.
Yeah.
Into the cover of Time Fades Away.
Cameron Crowe actually used this cover. He did an homage to it in Almost Famous, when the lights...
Oh, is that when Stillwater comes out and plays Fever Doll? Yeah.
He like perfectly has the camera set up, and there's a guy giving the peace sign, and then there's a rose on stage. It's a pretty cool moment.
Wow.
Yeah. And if you're kind of final note on Time Fades Away, if you are interested in more about this tour and hearing more of it, there was a Neil Young show released here in early 2019, the February 5th, 1973 show from Tuscaloosa. And that's a really, really, really great live album.
That's quite good. So, segueing from Neil Young to another rock and roll with a gigantic, to put it simply, discography. We're going to talk about the version of A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall from Bob Dylan's Rolling Thunder Review. In particular, this is the version from Volume 5 of the bootleg series, which I think was the first released evidence of the Rolling Thunder Review.
Yep.
I mean, it had been endlessly bootlegged. I mean, if you wanted to find it, it was out there. This was made it relatively easy to find. And I'll always preface this by saying I'm always hesitant to talk Bob Dylan on the podcast because, you know, I mean, Dylan and his catalog could fill up 17 podcasts on their own, and those who like Dylan really like him, so I don't ever want to step on any toes. But I just remember being, you know, I probably went through my most hardcore Dylan phase in college, as really many do. And was always made to believe that A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, it was, you know, like the tender, rather somber acoustic classic from the freewheeling Bob Dylan. So when I finally heard the Rolling Thunder Review version in 2002, I thought, okay, this is not that. This is Rockets Rock and Roll played a very high tempo, and he's singing it in a way that's so biting. It's almost like he's making fun of the original song. I mean, maybe that was the idea. But this is the Rolling Thunder review is a bit of a hootenanny. I mean, he's got like David Mansfield, legendary musician playing pedal steel. He's got David Bowie's guitarist from the Spiders of Mars band, Mick Ronson, Scarlett Rivera on violin, Joan Baez, T-Bone Burnett kind of almost got his start with this band. I mean, just like a lot of names that kind of reads like a who's who, like backing musicians for Rock and Roll Hall of Fame artists. And, you know, this was, I think when it first came out, a lot of people complained that, you know, this doesn't even attempt to capture like an actual set list. This isn't a full show. This is kind of like it takes from a few nights in the first leg of the tour in November of 1975. But otherwise, I mean, it's a mind-blowing rock and roll record. And this is just an incredible performance of the song. And obviously, Dylan, the studio records never tell the tale because he's changing up his songs left and right on stage.
Yeah, this I remember when this was when I first heard this was in high school, and kind of similar to you, I'd been introduced to Dylan as this folk singer-songwriter and really thought of him as a product of the 60s. And kind of even before I listened to his 64 to 66 Renaissance, I remember hearing this, and it was the first time I'd learned about Dylan's second peak, which was in the mid 70s. And a lot of that surrounds Blood on the Tracks and this record. Yeah, it sounds like you fused 1963 Bob Dylan with 1966 with that very isolated New Morning Woodstock, New York Dylan with, I don't know, some like mysterious character from his imagination, in that it sounds like it's very Americana. But it's also this kind of amalgamation of the character that Dylan had been creating and crafting for the better part of 20 years. So yeah, this is a wild version. This record is filled with both Desire era and, Blood on the Tracks era Dylan songs, as well as reworkings of songs from the 60s. And definitely, again, this was one of those first times I learned, okay, when you hear Dylan a few years apart, you're hearing him completely rework songs. And, you know, not two or three years later, he had, you know, come out as a Christian fundamentalist, said he was converted. And there's a bootleg series that came out about that. I forget what it's called now. The bootleg series from that Christian fundamentalist tour, Trouble No More. And you hear all these new and totally different Dylan songs with like this very, very tight band. And anything you heard from that era that where he was playing older songs, it's with this very tight band. It completely sounds different from Rolling Thunder. So he was constantly reworking stuff. And this just catches him at a very high career peak and a moment where he kind of tapped into, like I said, these characters that were floating around his head, and it just produced some very high energy music. So what do you think?
And if you want more, they just released like a 14 disc box set.
It's so good. I got it. It's so good, man. It's like show by show. And while the set lists don't vary that much, there's such great music on there. And every single night they're bringing the same level of energy.
And then there's the Martin Scorsese Netflix documentary, which was just released. Mm-hmm. I haven't watched it yet because my life with a 5-year-old, the 4-month-old doesn't exactly lend itself to watching Martin documentaries on Netflix. I think it makes it like fact with fiction. I think there's like some, there's some untruths. But supposedly the live footage is like good enough that, you know, if you want like a really good Dylan movie, it's supposedly a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think there have been some people who wrote about it. Jesse Jarno wrote a really great essay on it.
Yes.
That it's a really good Dylan movie while being a really bad Dylan documentary, I think is how he phrased it. I could be slightly off in terms of that. But the point being that it feels like something out of the mystique of Bob Dylan rather than a like no direction home from 2005 that Scorsese directed, is a very clear, proper documentary about Dylan. This is a little bit more in the kind of atmospheric, experimental type of approach.
But with Rolling Thunder Review, he kind of took on the role of a roving gypsy, in a sense. So it kind of makes sense that a documentary would mix the fact with the fiction.
Absolutely.
So in any event, let us listen to now A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall from Volume 5 of the Bootleg Series, The Rolling Thunder Review.
As well as let's listen to Time Fades Away from Neil Young's Time Fades Away.
Yeah, both of them. Do it.
Sun don't be home. Whiskey Mountains. Watching a cold on six jagged hours. Been in the middle of seven sad forests. Been out in front of the desert dead oceans. Been 10,000 miles to the mouth of a graveyard. And it's a high. Well, it's a high. Well, it's a high. And it's a high. Well, it's a high. Rain going about. What did you see? Did you see when I'm in your world? So the moon, baby, with wild wounds all around it. So a highway of diamonds with nobody on it. So a black branch with blood that kept dripping. So a room full of men with their hammers bleeding. So a white ladder covered in water. So 10,000 talkers whose tongues are out broken. Guns and sharp swords in the hands of young children. It's a high, well it's a high, well it's a high, and it's a high, oh that's a high way for the fall. What did you hear, my blood son? What did you hear, my darling young one? Heard the sound of a thunder that roared out a warning. Heard the roar of a wave to drown.
Guys, so from two of our favorite classic rock icons, singer-songwriters who just paved the way for so many to come, we're going to jump into new album recommendations here, because we can talk Fish, we can talk about some of our favorite artists, but we always have to be trying to go beyond the pond. And that is one of the greatest spirits of this segment. So in this segment, I'm going to talk about the singer-songwriter, goes by the name Sandy Alex G, and his newest record, House of Sugar. So this is the follow-up record for Alex Gianascoli to the heavily praised Rocket from 2017, which was a record I personally did not care for. This one, House of Sugar, is indie pop experimentation brilliance. So Alex G is a Philadelphia-based musician and songwriter who crafts organic and anti-form indie pop songs that really sound unlike any other music I'm currently hearing. The closest comparison I can make to this album is Panda Bear's Person Pitch from 2007. It sounds like bedroom indie pop mixed with layers and layers of samples, and everything just always feels like it can fall apart completely here, but somehow stays together in this very loose and loose way. Imagery is flooded in and out of each song. Some of the imagery is opaque without form. Other images are specific ideas that you latch onto. It's equally confounding and frustrating in a strangely welcome way. Alex G has been working with Jacob Portrait to mix his records since 2015, and this continues his successes of seamlessly blending noise and acoustic strumming in a way that equally sounds homemade while also benefiting from the nuanced perfection of a professional studio. You know, in that note, it never sounds overly produced. It sounds like it was made kind of happenstance in the moment. But there is a clear cohesion here that, you know, it's clear you need someone who really knows what they're doing from a mixing standpoint. The peak of the record for me is the song Gretel, which might be a top five song of the year. Side note to all this, this last week has been really insane for me personally. I've unfortunately lost two people close to me, one of which was very unexpected. And I've seen from a professional standpoint, there's a lot of transition going on professionally where I work, and it's been very emotional, and you know, it makes you feel somewhat insecure and off balance. But on Monday of this week, as we're recording, one of my really great friends passed me this song, told me I should listen to this record, to which I said, I didn't really like Rocket. He said, you have to listen to this song. Just listen to the song. Do me that favor. I listened to it, and it just made me instantly happy. It reminded me that there's always like brightness and goodness amidst this like insanity and sadness of the world at times. And I dove into the record, and I've just been absolutely loving it. So while I'm currently in the mix of compiling my top 200 albums of the decade, and I'm really focused on just going back through some of my favorite songs and favorite albums of the decade, it was a really welcome surprise to get a record like this that just blew me away in the moment and really put me in a position to revisit 2019 classic records all the same. So Dave, what do you got?
So for my new record I've been digging lately, it's a group called Lower Dens. The album is called The Competition. So Lower Dens are, this is their fourth album, I believe, Baltimore-based band that are the brainchild of one Jana Hunter, I believe is non-binary and or gender fluids. I will use the they or them pronoun to refer to them. And their band owes a lot to two things which I love, namely 80s synth pop and post-punk, notably that of New Order. You get a lot of really melodic Peter Hook-style bass lines in these songs, both of which work on the dance floor. And the album's only been out for about 2 weeks. I really have yet to dive too deep into the lyrical content of it. I only recently started listening to it, but Jana Hunter's voice is such that they could be singing the dictionary and it would come across as equally alluring and friendly. Kind of, but from what I gather, a theme of the album and a prior Lower Dens albums is to learn to function within and rebel against a capitalist society, thus calling the album The Competition. I think some of the songs in the album's latter half would appear to be directly addressing like Hunter's difficulties in discussing their gender choices with their family. And on the standout single, Young Republicans, they portray a highly sardonic brand of wit, the lyric that born without souls or blood or skin. We are young Republicans. Of course, that makes perfect sense, actually. Album reminds you a little bit of the Destroyer album, Dan Behar. The album Kaput, and it's kind of dedication to like gentle dance floor epics with more and a little reliance on the early New Order template. And while there isn't a single song quite as awesome as on the song To Die in L.A. from their last album, being 2015's Escape from Evil, song for song, I think the competition seems sonically sharper, probably the better record. But that's Lower Dens are certainly a band worth getting into.
I would agree completely. And I was so happy to see that you had put this on the outline before the episode here. Twin Hand Movement, I remember getting in 2010 and loving that record. And Escape from Evil in 2015 was definitely there in my honorable mentions of that year. And
that's an awesome record.
It's a really, really good record. And I have yet to hear the competition just because I've been going through the aforementioned listening project that I'm currently on. But I'm going to have that queued up here once I get through all my favorite albums of the decade. And I think Twin Hand Movement and Escape from Evil are definitely going to be on my list.
Absolutely. Yeah, the song To Die in L.A. actually came on in a bar in Chicago when I was with my wife with talking with Beyond the Pond superfan Kathleen Henkel and her new wife, Amanda. You just got married. Congratulations, Kathleen.
Yes, congrats.
That song came on the bar, and I was like, oh, fuck yeah, Lower Dens.
All right. So moving into segment two here, where we were talking about the year 1999, a year that is really being celebrated in its 20th anniversary. The Ringer Podcast Network, of which we are both huge fans, is doing a ton of podcasts about the great movies from that year, one of the best film years, if not the best film year of the last 30 years. The music was covered in a very big way by one of our favorite writers, thinkers, podcasters, Stephen Hayden, who covered Woodstock 99. And so we wanted to cover some of our favorite records from that year. We did this in episode 67 as well on the Cypress Split Up and Melt. I covered Midnight Vultures from Beck. What did you play? Or no, sorry. I covered Blur's 13 in that segment. What did you cover? Let me put you on the spot.
Oh, yeah. Olivia Tremor Control.
Oh, yeah. Cool. So we've got a couple more 1999, some of our favorite 1999 records. I'm going to start out with Bonnie Prince Billy's I See a Darkness that came out in January of 1999. So this was the sixth album from Will Oldham and the first under the moniker Bonnie Prince Billy. I was looking through past episodes. I'm pretty sure we've never formally featured Bonnie Prince Billy on BTP, which is crazy. He's one of the most important songwriters in my life. This record, He's Down the Road, The Brave and the Bold, which was recorded with Tortoise, as well as the album Beware, along with a bunch of his B-sides, were really foundational records for me as I learned where and when and how you could push beyond the norms of folk indie songcraft.
When did Timberwolf came out? Was that 2005?
Yes, that was 2005.
So fucking good.
Yeah, that one's amazing. This album, I See a Darkness, features the title track as well as the song A Minor Place that I've played solo for years. They mean a ton to me. I've always enjoyed playing these songs. It's a very solitary, reflective, honest, and dark record. And it really kind of set the table for where Bonnie Prince Billy was going to take his songwriting. Will Oldham, that is, but as the... under the guise of Bonnie Prince Billy, where he was going to take his songwriting for, you know, within the future. This was of note, ranked as the ninth best album of the 1990s by Pitchfork. And somehow, and I'm kind of shocked by this, though happy, this is on the list of the 1001 albums that you must hear before you die. Now, while the album Ease Down the Road is my favorite of his, this is certainly, I would argue, the highest point of the Bonnie Prince Billy project thus far. Since 2001, he's definitely made compelling music, but nothing as focused and essential as this record. And that's kind of part of the point for him. He's a constantly evolving musician and songwriter and actor and poet and photographer. He can't really sit still, both to a fault and to a benefit. I think we're all very lucky that we got an album like I See a Darkness out of Bonnie Prince Billy. And so from this, we're going to play the song Madeline Mary, which I think kind of fits as well the overall raucous late night energy of many of our selections here. So this is Bonnie Prince Billy, Madeline Mary, off of 1999's I See a Darkness.
Okay, Brian, I know I love Bonnie Prince Billy. Also has some of the best contributions to big national curated album of Grateful Dead covers that came out Day of the Dead a few years ago that we spoke about.
Yes, yes.
I think he does what, Birdsong and Ruben and Cherise on that?
Yeah, Ruben and Cherise is really, really fitting for him, but yeah, Birdsong is great.
So the album I'm going to talk about from 1999 is a band called Shaq. Not like Shaquille O'Neal, but Shaq is in like a rundown structure. The album is called HMS Fable. The song I'm going to play is called Natalie's Party. So like Brian was kind of mentioning, now that it's 1999, you see a lot of blogs doing like big 20th anniversary retrospective stories on certain albums, and people had all these lyrics about the millennium and what's 2000 going to bring. And HMS Fable is not one of these albums. So about 20 years ago, well, 99, there was a magazine called CMJ Monthly, which stood for College Music Journal Monthly. And this kind of featured all the hip indie bands that kids were listening to in those days. A lot of record stores gave it out for free, and it always came with a free mix CD, which kind of showcased the bands within the magazine. And that's how I learned about Shaq. A CD from CMJ contained the first song off this album, the very British-sounding anthem Natalie's Party, and I loved it. I needed to hear the rest. I think I found the album about a week later in the used bin at my local UCD store as a promo copy. Someone had it, felt like selling it there. I'm not entirely sure. It was only $8. So Shaq actually sprang up from the ashes of the somewhat precious 1980s Britpop band The Pale Fountains, and was led by the Head brothers, Michael, a.k.a. Mick Head, and John Head. I think that the debut Shaq album actually came out in 1987. And the second album, which is called The Water Pistol, was recorded in 1991, and as legend would have it, the studio that it was recorded in burned down like a few days before it was going to be released. And the only remaining tape was in the possession of the producer, who I think left it in a rental car. This is a true story. It was located and released in 1995. By this time, Mick Head was in the throes of some heroin addiction, unfortunately. So HMS Fable didn't come out until 1999, and I'm calling it a brilliant lost Britpop album because it's very well written, it's very lush, and really, I don't hear anybody talking about this album or this band anymore. And I mean, it's still, you can stream it on Spotify. I don't know where you would actually find this record, but it's certainly out there in the ether. And they kind of remind me a little bit of the Australian pop rock band Crowded House. Obviously British, where I think Crowded House are Kiwis. And several of these songs obliquely address McHead's heroin addiction, but most of them are happen to be love songs. And I think one of the biggest artists they owe a debt to is Loves, the band Love, the frontman Arthur Lee. I think they may have even served as the backing band for Arthur Lee in the early 90s. And I think if you have a Jones for the more like, I guess, like pretty strange of late 90s Britpop, say like Travis, say early Coldplay, Belle and Sebastian, or a Cast, then you really should really have to get yourself some HMS Fable. Like I said, it's streaming. I think there's been two Shaq albums that haven't been released since, but I don't think that the band is currently a functioning entity. I think, according to old Wikipedia, I think they played a show last in 2010 for like a charity event, but I don't know if they exist now. But yeah, this album is very well worth listening to. So let's listen to Natalie's Party off of the Shaq album, HMS Fable.
Look at all the villages in town and all the farmers hanging round. We're going up to everyone we meet, shooting off the mobs around the street. And look at all the locals getting down, 'cause it's Natalie's Party.
Guys, thank you for hanging with us here in episode 77, where we chronicled Cross-Eyed and Painless from December 31st, 1999 in Big Cypress. Amazing jam, led us to thinking about late night debauchery, raucous music, as well as the year 1999. And in so, we featured in segment one, Late Night Intensity and Speed, Neil Young's Time Fades Away off of Time Fades Away, as well as Bob Dylan's A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall off of the Rolling Thunder Review. And segment two, where we discussed 1999, we played Bonnie Prince Billy's Madeline Mary off of I See a Darkness, as well as Natalie's Party off of Shaq's HMS Fable.
As a reminder, you can always find us on social media, on Twitter, @_BeyondThePond, one word. Simplecast page, beyondthepond.simplecast.fm. And of course, we have the Spotify Beyond the Pond podcast song master playlist, which is incredibly unwieldy at this point. To the extent that songs are available on Spotify that we mentioned in the episode, we will put them there. There's now well over 450 songs in that list. Of course, we'd always encourage you to go out and buy vinyl records, go see the bands, buy some merchandise, because you know Spotify is good for sampling, but if you like something enough, there are better ways to get the bands paid. Also, you can find us and all of the other fantastic podcast with the Osiris Podcast family, which we are proud to be a part, on osirispod.com. And leave us an iTunes review. We always read them. We get a kick out of them, and it helps increase our visibility in Apple land.
Absolutely. And we are right now on a pretty big kick here in Beyond the Pond. This is our fifth of five episodes coming out here in September 2019. Just as a quick recap, we threw out an episode on the on Dix, especially on the ghost from Dix, as well as an episode on the Vancouver Tweezer, two episodes on 2015-2016 music, as well as here this Cross on Painless from Big Cypress. We have some pretty awesome records here coming out, we have some pretty awesome episodes that are coming up here in the fall, some great interviews. We're going to be counting down our top albums of the 2010s, jumping into our last Cypress jam of the year, covering some of Fish's fall tour, as well as going through our top albums of 2019 and our holiday special, our annual holiday special now, which is always a fun mulled wine tinged version episode. So yeah, good stuff. Some 2 week gaps, some less than 2 week gaps, but we appreciate you all for listening here and for giving us as much love as you have in 2019.
Absolutely. Thank you for hanging with this episode at this point. This was a fun episode to record. Brian, think you had a good time?
I think I had a good time.
I had a good time. Enjoyed it. So, come back, I think around 2 weeks. We will most certainly be back. We will hold hands. We will say kumbaya. We will fight fish myopia. And we will go beyond the pond. Osiris.